The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. A virus puts the political season on virtual hold as the country shuts down to slow a deadly virus.
Clearly, if we are going to flatten the curve, we need authoritarian measures.
Some countries like Taiwan, less than 100 miles from mainland China, got a good jump on the pandemic.
Taiwan was hit very hard by SARS. And we learned the lesson.
The research sector is liking its progress, working towards an effective drug.
When chloroquine is applied to cells in the lab, the coronavirus cannot attach to those cells, meaning that it is a preventative measure and it stops transmission.
And the great state of Ohio, under Governor DeWine's deft leadership, is showing other states how to manage this threat.
So what we do every single day is to try to, do everything we can to make the right decisions.
Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com, and let me invite you to join me now by video. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. And follow this program as well, at Town Hall Review. On Monday, March the 9th, the great American shutdown got rolling. Businesses starting informing their employees who had the ability to work from home to start doing so. Of course, sports were put on hold. The NBA, NHL, MLB, and MLS all suspending their seasons until further notice. Airlines facing an unprecedented slowdown. Hotels, restaurants, I could go on. All the while, we've watched the numbers on the virus steadily increasing. Looking at CDC's world map of virus infections, many of us noted how Taiwan had managed to keep the spread of the virus, well, under control. I spoke with Taiwan's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Joseph Wu, on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Minister Wu, how come Taiwan has done so much better than any other country? What did you do that the rest of the world needs to copy vis-a-vis the virus?
Even though we are quite successful so far, but our doctors or experts, our CDC officials are still very cautious at this moment. As we see it, we survived the first wave, the wave of origin from China, and then later by Korea. Now we are facing the second wave, which is the wave coming from Europe. And we know that there will be more coming over to this part of the world, which might be the United States. We will characterize it as the third wave. You asked about why or how we do better than other countries. I can tell you that we learned it from our experience. Taiwan was hit very hard by SARS back in 2002 and 2003, and we learned the lesson. So when we heard that there was some suspicious cases in the Wuhan, China, we started our command center, we started our task force in dealing with the situation. We mobilized the whole government to deal with the situation. We tried to control the border. We try to set up quarantine mechanism, and we try to set up tracing mechanism to deal with those cases. And so far, it's been successful.
Now, do you believe that the best practices that Taiwan has adopted are applicable and indeed possible to replicate in the United States?
Of course. If you look at the CDC officials in Taiwan, actually, they are being trained by the U.S. CDC officials. So if the United States started early, I'm sure the United States will be able to deal with the situation like the way Taiwan is dealing with it. If you look at the U.S. situation right now, it might be a little too late. And the situation can only be contained if we try to eliminate the community spread. We do it from zero, but the United States has to face the situation from a situation that there's already community spread. But of course, we need to work together with the United States at this moment or in the future. I think there has to be a global effort, and Taiwan is ready to work with the United States.
Now, Minister Wu, they had community spread on the mainland, and drastic measures were adopted. Do you think those measures are what every country should adopt, the same sort of draconian measures that were adopted on the mainland?
I don't think so. China is an authoritarian country, and is adopting those measures in a violation, in gross violation of human rights, and that is not the way to do it. I think there can be a more humane way of dealing with the situation.
A favorite regular guest of mine on World Affairs is retired Admiral James Stavridis. Having served as Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, the Admiral is well-equipped to speak about international threats such as the virus. The Admiral was clear on the magnitude of this challenge when he was a guest on my program. We meet in a time of virtual war, I believe.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And the invisible enemy is all around us. So we're in Florida. And I think of this, in a certain sense, like a hurricane. It's coming at you. You kind of know it's coming at you. You're going to do all the preparation you can, but you got to just get through it. But it is an unsettling time with a very difficult opponent.
I want to talk to you as a man of war. You spent 33 years studying war. And in that first conversation that we had about the virus, you said it's useful that it is in an authoritarian country with the hope that an authoritarian country could stop it. It didn't. Does America need measures that look authoritarian, though backed by the rule of law, the police power at the states, at this juncture?
We are at that point, and I say that with sorrow, but clearly, if we are going to flatten the curve, reduce the stress on the medical system, which I think is really the key to holding down massive numbers of deaths, we need fairly authoritarian measures. And back to China, they were not able to contain it within China because of early lies, the tendency of the state to crush dissent of any kind. But when they decided to put real authoritarian means around Wuhan, they were able to decrease the number of new infections. So I think we're looking at further stay-in-place kind of measures. Yes, Hugh, we're going to have to take a page from authoritarian books. No one likes that, but it's the right thing to do.
I don't want people to worry about martial law. Shelter in place and the use of the police power is not martial law. And I want people to understand the difference between that. You understand, you've traveled to 100 countries. You know the difference between the spectrum of liberties curtailed for a time and despotism.
Indeed. And that's precisely what we will see here. And also, let's, as you said up front, the courts are not going away. The military is not coming out of barracks and taking over. This is going to be a civil authority driven. We're not headed for survivalism here. Even at the worst case scenarios, we're going to be able to maintain order. We're going to have a number of deaths that the country could handle if we had to, and we can reduce those number of deaths. But in any case, this is going to be a hard blow, especially for our elderly. And as Dr. Fauci, as he has said, we must be mindful of the most vulnerable among us, and those are the elderly. There's no silver bullet here. There's no single point solution. Point one, put the money in the hands of the American public. They're going to spend it on durable goods. They're going to spend it on various things for the households. They're going to put it, some of it, I suspect, will recycle into the banks as savings. Secondly, in terms of government spending, we ought to be spending time looking at the next pandemic. So I would say some of the monies we spend ought to be spent in the medical world.
As we look for potential treatments for COVID-19, there is some early but promising news on the research from a research advisor at Stanford. My Salem colleague Kevin McCullough from AM970 The Answer in New York recently spoke with Gregory Regano. He's co-author of a recent paper on new applications for the drug chloroquine. We'll pick up with a clip from the president.
If we do this right, our country and the world, frankly, but our country can be rolling again pretty quickly.
I ran across Laura Ingraham on Fox News Channel saying this.
It's called chloroquine.
And that study found that use of chloroquine and its tablets is showing favorable outcomes in humans infected with coronavirus, including faster time to recovery and shorter hospital stays.
I found the study that she was referring to. It's titled An Effective Treatment for Coronavirus COVID-19. It was presented by a Columbia doctor and a researcher from Johns Hopkins University in consultation with Stanford University, the University of Alabama at Birmingham School of Medicine, and the National Academy of Sciences. If we have a vaccination process that people are trying to discover that vaccine and trying to work on getting that clinical test started, which they did to their credit, that is great. But if we've got an on-the-shelf drug that's been in the medicine toolbox since 1945, isn't it incumbent upon us to begin using that effectively now if we know that it's going to do good?
The most important point here is that hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine came about in World War II. To treat soldiers that were coming back from the East that have contracted malaria.
So let's get to the bottom line then for coronavirus then. So what did the summary of your research show as it relates to COVID-19? Now, I also saw in the report that U.S. CDC research says that not only is this an effective cure for people that are currently infected, but that it also serves as a potential preventative measure. How did they come about with how did they come up with that information?
That was actually a paper published in 2005, which shows that when chloroquine is applied to cells in the lab, the coronavirus cannot attach to those cells, meaning that it is a preventative measure and it stops transmission. We are starting to generate data amongst physicians, medical doctors who are on the front lines, who are actually starting to take a prophylactic dose of hydroxychloroquine so that they do not contract coronavirus from the patients that they are treating.
So
and we are planning to scale up a global clinical trial in which we will be enrolling high-risk patients, specifically medical doctors, that they do not contract it.
Greg, let's talk a little bit about why this hasn't been uncovered before now. I mean, South Korea seems to have really set the stage here. I think their fatality rate is somewhere under 1%, something like 0.7 or 0.8. How did South Korea know about this? How come the U.S. hasn't made it a part of our standard treatment thus far?
So first it started in China, then to South Korea. We can learn a tremendous amount from following what these countries did in response to this. Our kind of decentralization continues in that now we're working with MDs and PhDs between California, Michigan, New York, France, Australia, and other parts of the world.
Coming up.
So what we do every single day is to try to do everything we can to make the right decisions, because the example that I've given, that is St. Louis in 1918. This was the pandemic. This has killed so many people around the world. And St. Louis, they got it right.
Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Although much of our news on COVID-19 has come from the office of our president, there's strong leadership from state governments. Such is the case with my home state of Ohio, where Governor Mike DeWine has served since January of last year. Governor DeWine has quickly assembled a leadership team to mitigate the spread of the pandemic. I spoke with him about his efforts on my program. Are you surprised by the fact you've become a model of leadership for the country?
Yeah, we're just focusing on what we need to do every day. And certainly had no idea this was coming, but I wanted someone really strong who could not only run the health department, but really speak to people about health issues. And
Governor, what I want to talk to you about is not the actual specifics of the pandemic. I want to talk to you about leadership, because what you've done in the last month has impressed the country, as has many other governors. It's not exclusive to you, but you have been a real model of this. Would you tell us, and thereby inform other people in leadership positions in private and public sector, how you go about your day and what your goals are to deal with a crisis that is exploding?
Well, our goal has been to try to get ahead of this, and you can't really get ahead of it. But, you know, what I've done, Hugh, is I assembled a group of 14 doctors in Ohio, but we all as consultants. So I've been on the phone with other doctors, other modelers, people who model these pandemics. And that's really where we've gotten our information. And the message that kept coming back to us, particularly from the people who model these pandemics, is you have to move early. And if you don't move early, you're going to kill a lot more people. So what we do every single day is to try to, do everything we can to make the right decisions, because the example that I've given, and it's not original to me because it's a part of our history, and that is St. Louis in 1918. This is 102 years ago. This was the pandemic. This has killed so many people around the world. And St. Louis, they got it right. They moved within 2 days of actually knowing what was going on. They shut everything down. They shut the churches down. There's a kind of interesting side note. The bishop was upset, apparently, with the mayor. But, eventually everybody got on the same page, and they got what needed to be done. Philadelphia, on the other hand, they got it, but they got it 2 weeks later. In other words, they figured out what to do 2 weeks later, just 2 weeks. And the death rate in Philadelphia was dramatically higher than it was in St. Louis. So it's drilling down on the facts. And I'll tell you, Hugh, you asked about leadership. I can just tell you two things. People ask me, how have you made these decisions? I said, look, I've been in government for 40-some years, and I've made plenty of mistakes. And the mistakes that I have made, they're caused generally by not having enough facts, by not consulting the right people, by not drilling down, by not asking enough questions. And so what I resolve to do in this is just every day keep asking the question. What else can we do? Are there other things we need to be doing? Every morning when I walk in with our team, that's my first question. What else can we be doing? And getting the facts from the experts was very important. The other thing that I've found in my career is that if when I had the facts and I didn't trust my gut, I made a mistake. And so those are kind of my two guiding principles. And my instinct throughout this has been, we got to move faster. Early on, that I needed to be a communicator to the people of Ohio. The part of my job was to tell them the truth.
One of the most shocking aspects of this battle against the spread of the virus is how many businesses have been shut down. First, air travel was tightened. That affected hotels, then ground transportation, then came restaurants. The president had been doing what he needed to do, going big, proposing aggressive and unprecedented measures to help the economy and the American worker. One of the strongest economies in the world is taking a serious hit. Chris Stiegel, my Salem colleague in Philadelphia, turned to veteran economist Stephen Moore, now serving at the Heritage Foundation. From AM 990, The Answer.
I think people are kind of freaked out naturally right now, but we are going to get through this. It's going to be, probably hopefully anywhere between 3 and 6 weeks that this will last, and then we'll have to contain this virus. And when we do, when it comes, I really believe strongly two things are going to happen. One is that the stock market's going to just snap right back up. It may take, a few months for that to happen, but there's a lot of buying opportunities out there right now. You're very foolish if you sell your stocks right now. You're selling at the bottom. You never want to do that. And second of all, I think the U.S. economy really pops back. But we're in for some tough, this is going to be some tough sledding.
Steve, I don't want to quibble because we don't know. It's all unknown. But you said 3 to 6 weeks. The president talking July or August, he said yesterday in the press conference. I mean,
I'm not a health expert. I've talked to some health experts in recent days and weeks. But I think the president was just being very cautious in that statement. I mean, if this lasts till August, the U.S. economy is going to be very, very, very severe. That's why, so the answer is we don't really know. All we know is from past experience. Usually these things burn out, by when springtime comes. And so, let's hope that's the case. But if this lasts to August, it's going to be pretty brutal because you're talking about so much economic activity because of the social distancing that's happening. It's going to be, in that case, it's like a 10% reduction in the economy at the least. Now, what I'm saying, though, is that when that day comes, hopefully sooner than later, where we can feel like this is crested, I think that the term they're using is, you know, flattening the curve so that we don't see exponential growth, that we see a leveling off and then decline.
Yeah.
And then I think, yeah, look, we have, Chris, you and I talked about this several weeks ago, before the coronavirus, we had the best economy ever.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
We had 7 million surplus jobs. We had the lowest unemployment rate in 50 years, thank God. You know, so we go into this with a very sturdy economy. Imagine if, you know, we had an economy like that of Europe or many of these Asian countries. The pain and suffering from this would be, you know, in terms of the economy, would be much more severe. I think we get through this, I think, by, you know, I think by actually midsummer, we're just, the economy's back, firing on all cylinders again.
Here's what I can imagine is happening. I don't know, but I mean, I could just guess. I could guess that the president has people like you who are invaluable and have brains for the economy and know exactly what needs to be done economically. He has brains for the health element of this and what needs to be done from a health perspective. And I would guess the prognoses for both often conflict violently. That must be difficult for the president to hear both.
So all I was saying is, you know, there is a bit of an overreaction by people to this. And heard you just talking about China. I mean, there's going to have to be some changes now, right? I mean, I think where the U.S. government has really fallen down is that we haven't had the testing that we need. So we know how many people have the virus, and we can ice, you know, we can quarantine them so that they don't infect other people.
Do you think China owes us something here, Steve? I got to ask you. Somebody called me earlier, and they said, does China owe us something here? Do we need to take this out of their hides, so to speak?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say they owe us because of the fact that this virus originated. Where they owe us is they, we have relied on them for the manufacture and the production of these treatments and other kinds of antibiotics that we need right now, and we should not have allowed that to happen.
Coming up,
it's like chemotherapy. You know, you kill the cells now in order to save the patient, and we need to shut everything down now because if we don't, it'll get much worse.
Dennis Prager with Heather McDonald when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Not everyone is in lockstep with what's happening in our nation's dramatic efforts to slow the spread of the virus. There's no question. The shutdown of life as we know it has sent shockwaves through the nation. Heather McDonald is a pro-life author serving at the Manhattan Institute. She's also a contributing editor for the City Journal and a frequent guest on the Salem Radio Network. McDonald wrote a piece in New Criterion entitled, Compared to What? Here's Heather McDonald with Dennis Prager.
I would like to poll Americans on how many support the closing of all schools, the closing of all restaurants, the end of airline travel as we know it, and so on for an indefinite period of time. Maybe the vast majority of Americans support it. I don't know. She wrote a piece in New Criterion. It's called Compared to What? This is what she writes. Compared to what? That should be the question that every fear-mongering news story on the coronavirus has to start with. So far, the United States has seen 41 deaths. I think it's now up to 60 or 70. From the infection, 22 of those deaths occurred in one poorly run nursing home outside of Seattle. Another 9 deaths occurred in the rest of Washington state, leaving 10 deaths. This represents roughly 0.00012% of the U.S. population. Heather, have you changed your mind since you wrote this piece?
Well, Dennis, I certainly understand the compounding problem and the fear that this simply jumps the fence and takes off. But I'm still looking at these numbers. There seems to be some very odd decisions being made as to who gets protected by these quarantine rules, social distancing rules, and those basic workers in our economy that we assume will keep soldiering on, and the basic functioning of our extraordinarily beautiful free market system that, as our elites strip our stores of goods, the next day manages to put the products back on the shelves. It is a thing of absolute glory and miracle.
Do you know the government actually told people, the national government and local governments, to stock up with 2 weeks of food and water? I saw it. I actually saw it. Did you know that?
No, I didn't, but it's not surprising because, frankly, in one sense, you know, what you have is when it becomes rational to be irrational. This is a fantastic live experiment in mob psychology and social psychology where if everybody else is hoarding, it's a tragedy of the commons, and it becomes rational to hoard yourself, lest you be the one person when there's nothing on the shelves. So in the government's case here, if the measures continue and those supply chains are broken and trucks can't come into, say, the island of Manhattan or Pacific Palisades, I don't know, then that becomes reasonable advice. But, of course, it only prolongs and compounds the problems. So it's a very, very difficult issue to sort out. I can't say that I know where a alternative middle ground is between a reckless laissez-faire attitude and hyper-hysteria, but I do think that our cost-benefit calculus has to be perhaps more sensitive to the long-term, even the health effects of a worldwide depression or recession.
You mentioned that there was a two-class system at work here. I think there's a two-class system at work with regard to the hysteria, because the intellectuals driving this, in the media, for example, and in academia and in science, they are not affected. They're going to keep their jobs. They're saying to tens of millions of Americans, go broke, because this is such a serious illness. I won't go broke, but you should.
That's absolutely right. I would say, they would say, yes, but we understand that it's necessary. It's like chemotherapy, you know. You kill the cells now in order to save the patient, and we need to shut everything down now because if we don't, it'll get much worse. So it's a real empirical question. What would happen if we did not impose these draconian measures? But for sure, the Manhattan storefronts are already shuttered. All of the small entrepreneurs that have put their life capital at risk are no way going to be able to hold out through this.
That's right.
And they employ
millions
of people.
That's right. Coming up.
To just hunker down for a couple of weeks, see what the trend of the outbreak is.
Dr. Anthony Fauci on the impact on seniors of the coronavirus when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. One of the features of the strain of coronavirus called COVID-19 is that it tends to hit seniors age 60 and older, often with devastating results. This was clear with the first 20-plus death that occurred here in the United States. It's a comfort, then, for seniors in the entire nation to see Dr. Anthony Fauci at the side of the president, often at the mic after the president has spoken, as a member of the president's coronavirus task force. It was a privilege when Dr. Fauci found time. He is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease director, as well as a member of the task force, to join me on my program. Now, I want to drill down on seniors, my target audience. We got 6 million people listening to this show. The vast majority of them are between 45 and 64, but we got a lot of older people as well. A lot of grandparents, including me. All of my grandkids are under 9. This weekend, I was going to go drive and see them because my daughter's alone. My son-in-law is deployed. And there are 3 kids under 9. And she said to me yesterday, don't come. Is she right?
You know, she is. Right now, what we're trying to do at the White House Task Force press conference, we made an announcement to really ratchet up some of the guidelines for what we call physical and social distancing. And one of them is, if you have someone who is elderly, and particularly an elderly person with an underlying condition, such as heart disease and lung disease or diabetes, that puts them at an increased risk of getting the complications of coronavirus if, in fact, they get infected, you really want to protect those vulnerable people. So the guideline, as stringent as it sounds, is appropriate because it has worked in other settings, is to essentially have these individuals, the elderly, self-isolate in the home for at least the next 15 days to see what the direction of this outbreak is. And that means physical separation. Now, you don't want to make someone so socially lonely that their life is miserable, but you want to physically separate yourself from them because a young person might go out into the community, get infected, and we know now from good experience with China, with South Korea, and now most recently with Italy and France, that younger individuals who get infected tend to do very well. Some of them have minimal symptoms as opposed to the chance of getting into trouble. So a young person may go out, get infected, and inadvertently come back, and by physical interaction with the elderly or those with compromised immune systems, might actually infect them. And then the consequences are much more severe than a younger person getting infected.
So, Dr. Fauci, I'm going to use myself as an example, and we'll expand from there. I'm 64. I'm in terrific shape. Just had my physical. Ran 7 miles on Kauai a week ago. In fact, the Spouting Horn. I know you run every day, 3.5 miles. I've got runners back and a tear and a rotator cuff, but I'm in great shape. My grandkids are healthy. You would still tell me, don't go visit them.
No, you know, I would tell you the following, that in as a general guideline rule, you should not. But, you know, when you talk about the elderly, particularly if, as you say, you are otherwise really quite healthy, you know, there's a numerical age and there's a physiologic age. And some people who are 55, 60 are really kind of, you know, compromised because they don't age well. Whereas some people 75 and even 80 who are vigorous, athletic, and they do well. So when you get a guideline and have a cutoff and you say, well, if you're 70 years of age or older, there really needs to be some flexibility in interpreting that. I mean, if you want to be totally safe, then you overshoot and say, okay, I'm 60 years old, I'm 65, but I'm very, very healthy, but I'm still going to self-isolate because even though I'm very healthy and I have no issues or problems, I'm not going to take a chance.
Well, let's expand it out, doctor. We've got seniors who live for golf and who live for tennis. And they've got regular golfing partners, and they got regular tennis partners, and they want to go to their club, and they say, oh, it's all very clean, and I'm only going to see the caddy, and I'm only going to see the bag boy, and I'm going to play 18 with my friend who's also very healthy. Do you want them to stay home?
Well, in general, yes. But,
perfect.
Again, with exceptions, for example, you don't want people to have crowds that are 10 or more. You don't want to say after you've been one-on-one with someone, you then go to the bar and have a few drinks with 50 people in the bar.
Yep.
Those are the kind of things you don't want to do. But if you want to bend on the side of caution, I would say even though it's relatively low risk to go out and mingle with a few people for now, for the 15-day trial period, I think it's the better part of valor, if you are an elderly person, to just hunker down for a couple of weeks, see what the trend of the outbreak is.
The hardest question for me to answer is, during the summer when the virus appears to disappear, will it be iterating into a more deadly virus? Is there any science to tell us if we're getting crowd immunity or if it's going to come back in a more virulent form?
You know, we do not know. When we suppressed the SARS coronavirus, it went away and never came back. We are hoping that if we can suppress this by mitigation and by containment over the next few months, that when we get into the deep summer, that it will disappear. If it doesn't and come back, hopefully that will give us more breathing room to develop therapies as well as a vaccine. But the straight, but the direct answer to your question is, we do not know if it will come back and how it will come back. It's a possibility, but we just need to be prepared for it.
I am curious if there is other good news on interventions for those who are suffering from virus pneumonia and related maladies. Are there any new interventions that have crossed your screen?
Oh, there are several that are in clinical trial. They have not yet been proven to be effective, but there are a number of interventions, what we call therapies, direct antiviral therapies, that are being tested in China and some that are even being tested here in the United States.
Now, my last technical question has to do with the CDC and the testing breakdown. What happened on the testing development?
You know, it was a complicated series of multiple things that conflated that just, you know, went the wrong way. One of them was a technical glitch that slowed things down in the beginning. Nobody's fault. There wasn't any bad guys there. It just happened. I believe now that the CDC and the FDA and the department, that we've got it right now, because we're handing much of it over to the private sector, the heavy hitter companies that do this for a living. And I think what you're going to be seeing looking forward is a major, major improvement in the availability of testing.
Coming up.
The vaccine will come. We have to make sure it's safe. We have to make sure it's effective. But if we can just slow the transmission of this virus until it gets there, we will all be okay.
Dr. Nicole Sapphire on the final segment of our program. Stay with us. This week, a special coronavirus edition. The epidemic shuts down the world.
There's more going on here than many of us are even comprehending right now.
Some refuse to believe there is a problem.
The people without symptoms are in all likelihood the ones that are most contagious, that are most effective at spreading this disease.
China claims things are better in their part of the world.
I think that it's probably worse than the regime says.
And we'll discuss how believers should respond.
Think seriously about how to make sure that we're protecting each other from the virus. At the same time, to not be acting primarily out of fear, but out of love.
To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Events of the last few weeks have been sobering. They've also brought to the fore dozens of talented doctors, researchers, and epidemiology experts we'd never seen before, and now we've grown to love. This is one of the many blessings Americans enjoy. Not only is America's healthcare system one of the world's very best, so is our ability to respond to new diseases. Here's Joe Piscopo from AM 970 The Answer in New York with Dr. Nicole Sapphire, author of a brand new book, Make America Healthy Again.
Before we go to all the stats about the coronavirus, it building up your immune system. That's what it's all about, correct, Doc?
So let me tell you, Joe, that is it's interesting that I actually wrote this book. You know, the subtitle is How Bad Behavior and Big Government Has Caused Our Trillion-Dollar Problem. And so I actually wrote an op-ed a couple weeks ago for FoxNews.com saying that it is the level of chronic illness in our country that will actually render us vulnerable to this illness, because we have a robust combination private and public healthcare system, but we are far better off than many of these other countries that we see floundering with this illness. But it is our own bad behavior and the chronic illness that may actually have more of an effect on Americans.
Are you feeling that we will get there sooner rather than later as far as a vaccine and a cure to stop the uptick of this coronavirus?
Yeah, well, you make an excellent point. And the truth is, a lot of people continue to compare this to the swine flu of 2009, but that's not a good comparison. The last time we found ourselves in the face of a pandemic caused by a virus that we have no vaccine prepared for was, in fact, the 1918 Spanish flu.
Wow.
But let's also remember that that was a time before hand hygiene. We didn't even really know that we had germs living on our hands, at least for the most part. So at least in 2009, when the swine flu hit, that was caused by the influenza virus, which causes our everyday flu. And although we didn't have a vaccine specific to that strain, we already had our generic vaccine that they just needed to work on a little bit. Now, with this one, this is a novel coronavirus, meaning a coronavirus we've never seen before. So we had to start at zero to make this vaccine. And the Chinese released the genetic sequence within a couple of days, which was significantly shorter than they did with SARS, which actually helped. And our U.S. researchers had a vaccine in the works and developed in record-breaking time. And they had said that they guesstimated that the clinical study would start at the end of April. Well, they just injected the first person this week. That is in record time.
Wow.
Getting a vaccine in human trials. And that is all because it's under the leadership of Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx and the Trump administration removing some of that red tape to get it out there. Everyone is working together to get this out as fast as possible. The vaccine will come. We have to make sure it's safe. We have to make sure it's effective. But if we can just slow the transmission of this virus until it gets there, we will all be okay.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. All God's best to you and yours during these uncertain and troubling times. Stay with us here and with me, Hugh Hewitt, on my program, as we continue to bring you the latest news and development. We will see this through. We will emerge on the other side stronger, more united. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin, producer Charlie Richard, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and of course, the one and only Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.